Okay, this week's Parsha is Parshas Chayei Sarah. The title is Greatness Never Dies. We will continue this. So, this week, this past Shabbat, Friday and Shabbat, was a very difficult time for the Jewish community. We did lose two Jewish leaders, very different. I'm going to sort of give you a sense of this. And ironically, this week's Parsha starts off with the death and passing of Sarah, and we're going to explore different ideas in the concept and how to do a eulogy, and then we're going to end up with a positive note. So that's our game plan. We're going to start sad, and we're going to build from there, okay? But sad stuff is part of life, too, and we don't want to run away from it, especially, a Jewish conception is that we don't ignore the passing of certainly family and friends and certainly of great people in the Jewish community. So I'm just going to sort of share a little bit as an intro. Then, of course, we're going to go to a video, obviously. We've got to do the video. So I just want to share a sort of like a little bio, a sense of Rabbi David Feinstein, who was the son of Rav Moshe Feinstein. I'm sure. Raise your hand if you heard the name Rav Moshe Feinstein. Okay, so Rav Moshe Feinstein died in 1986. Was sort of one of the preeminent halacha poseks and our legal deciders of the world, really. Which means, so you know, I have my halacha Q&A question. The people ask me questions, ping me with little questions about Kashrut, and all, and Shah, you know, every imaginable question. But let's say, and I do get them from time to time, a question that I don't feel I'm qualified to answer. So what I will do is I'll take it to the next level. I got to go to the rabbi's rabbi. In other words, all rabbis have rabbi's rabbis, okay? So those are called poskim, people who are adept, trained, and specialize in dealing with more challenging and complex halacha questions, okay? Just the same thing with every profession. You have a general lawyer who has, let's say, a general expertise, but if it's a very complicated question, they're going to move it up the line to a specialty. So to a doctor, you might have a general practitioner doctor, or you're going to move it up to a specialist, depending on the situation. Now, the question is, let's say you got a super hard question, okay? So, for example, Rav David Feinstein, who took over as the Rosh Hashiva of Yeshiva MTJ, Masifta Tiferet Yushalayim in the Lower East Side. He took over for his father. So my Rosh Hashiva, my head of the yeshiva that I got smicha from, right, Yisrael Chait, got smicha from his dad, Rav Moshe Feinstein. But if he had a end-of-life question, what does that mean? Person's in the hospital. There are questions about intubation. There's a question about DNRs, do not resuscitate. The question about whether you have to hospice care issues. Question or not, do you have to do Herculean, you know, therapies. Questions of life and death, basically. Okay? So my Rosh Hashiva did not, you know, handle the few. And then if it was like, he felt it was too complicated, he would push it upstairs to Rav David Feinstein. Basically, the most challenging halakha questions would go to him, okay? I unfortunately had to call him about a year, 2 years ago. I was involved with an end-of-life issue, and I called, you know, I tried to get hold of him. So in other words, he's that call who's dealing with that. In other words, let me explain why that's so significant. If you pull the plug or withdraw treatment, whatever it may be, and it's not permissible, and I'm not saying there are cases where it is permissible or not, you're involved in a case of murder. You know what I'm saying? So it's literally a life or death halakha question. So it's not like, you know, there's a dairy spoon in my flagship dishwasher, what do I do? Now, I don't want to minimize that thing, but you do know that low-tier sock, thou shalt not murder, in the Ten Commandments, that's a big one, okay? That's a big one, all right? So he would be able to deal with those types of questions, basically any questions, okay? And he really was, he really continued his father's legacy. You know, he absorbed all that learning and was the go-to person. Now, if you met him, he was a very unassuming person, very quiet guy. You know, you sort of felt his humility, kind of person. You know, the kind of guy that tried to get lost in the room versus a person who's trying to stand out in the room. You know what I'm saying? Okay. In fact, he didn't, as a even though he's the head of the head of the yeshiva, he didn't want to daven in front. You know what I'm saying? He wants to daven. He wanted to lay low. He was really a humble person, and people, you know, people came to him with all kinds of problems, parnasa problems, problems of all kinds of issues, and he was there for them. People who were, you know, had a very, you know, small connection would ask him to be Masader Kedushin, and he would go to New Jersey. Why? A Jew asked me to help him out. That's it. Not complicated. Not complicated in principle, complicated in execution. You know what I'm saying? I mean, we're, you know, so it's a significant loss, because we don't have somebody of that caliber. You know, there's not that many people of that caliber. I mean, look, there's whatever generation we will deal with what we got. But I'm just saying it's a person who was in his personal midot. He'd walk around the people in the Lower East. He lived his whole life in the Lower East Side. Jew and non-Jew knew him. They called him David. Okay. David. And I mean, they're like, you know, very chill, unassuming guy who really was essentially a Torah giant. You know what I'm saying? But you would not know that from if you're speaking with him. You know what I'm saying? You would be very comfortable with him. Quiet person, very nice person. So he's really a person who manifests the perfection of the Torah in a way that you could feel, sense, in a sensory level. And that truth is, that's really similar to his father, of Moshe Feinstein, who, when he walked through the streets of the Lower East Side, to all the storekeepers, Jewish, non-Jewish, good morning, how are you, Steve? How are you, Karen? How's it going? He was a person who had a very warm thing. I'm going to share you one picture I got on my WhatsApp. This all sort of captures it all in one picture. I got it in one picture. Okay, so I'm going to do a share screen. So this is a picture of Rav David Feinstein at Reserve Cut. Reserve Cut is one of the preeminent kosher restaurants in Lower Manhattan. I'm not sure how they're still in business. Let's hope for them, you know, and like all the restaurants in Manhattan.
I'll tell you how, Rabbi, if you want to know.
Okay, we'll talk about that later. It's not the focus of the class. But so that's Rav David Feinstein, and this is with a person. He took this is his guy's birthday. He's alone. I don't know what the case was, but basically he was, you know, he took him out to dinner because there was nobody else to be with him for his birthday. So he had no one to celebrate with. Now, you have to understand, this is a person who, when he's not involved in communal things or giving a shiur to his yeshiva or learning or preparation or trying to research difficult halachic questions, which is, you know, he's basically, you know, he's learning, but yet he took off an evening for a person who's lonely. I mean, just, you know, I'm just giving you and somebody covertly took that picture. That was like, you know, that was sort of like a paparazzi sneaky picture. So whatever, I'm just saying, a person who is a Torah great person is a person who, on their midos level, you can sense their perfection. You know what I mean? They treat everybody with a smile. There's a warmth. There's a concern. Chesed. And, of course, they have the greatness of Torah. That's what a Torah great person is. So that was Erev Shabbos, about an hour before Shabbos, and I posted that. That was That was that, and they had the funeral on Sunday. Then, of course, you know, that was a big bummer, and that was difficult. And then, of course, I open up my phone, Motzi Shabbos, and then I get, Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks had passed away. And like Rabbi Sacks, it was Rabbi Wild's point on a couple of his posts, it was a very big shock. I mean, I don't know if anybody's on his celebrating, he has a WhatsApp group, Celebrating Life. I don't know what it's called. I forgot what it's called.
Yeah, there's like 83 groups.
Celebrating Life. Okay, whatever. But so I literally got a recording on the Parsha, you know, an 8-minute recording of Parsha that morning. Now, obviously, it's pre-recorded, but I looked on his Facebook. He had been doing, you know, his classic broadcast videos like up to like 6 weeks ago. And obviously we found out he got cancer a couple times. The cancer came back. We don't even know what the details was. Was it a recurring cancer? Was it a new cancer? And then it was a shock. It was really a shock. Nobody anticipated that. So I want to share maybe just the first half of his daughter's eulogy. We're going to analyze it. And the goal of us is to be able to learn some of the principles of what makes a good eulogy. I want to tell you, as a rabbi who has officiated, shall we say, too many funerals. That's the amount of funerals I've done. Too many is the answer. Most people don't know what they're doing. And as such, you know, it could have been so much better. You know, I'll just leave it like that. And so you are going to be called upon to step up there, and it's a tremendous mitzvah. I don't want to minimize it. It's a tremendous mitzvah to step up there to honor for a relative or a close friend to share a hesped. So that's our goal tonight, is clarifying what is a hesped, what are the components of a hesped, how to do it right. So we're going to start with a fresh example. I'm going to share, this is Gila Sacks, the youngest of the three children of Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, who spoke on behalf of the entire family, which obviously that's a big pressure. And, of course, no pressure, but, of course, it's being videoed and simulcast for, I don't know, maybe, you know, tens of thousands of Jews worldwide that caught the live stream on Sunday morning. Okay, so that's our goal, and we're going to go to the videotape. So this is, here we go with Gila Sacks. And we're going to see only half, but I'm going to get to, we'll see how it goes.
And to finish this part of the proceedings, on behalf of the family, Gila. Begin to know how to say thank you to him. That will take time. For now, I wanted just to share two moments from the past few days, which helped me to understand what he has given me. The first was a work phone call a few days ago, totally unconnected to my father. A colleague and I were discussing COVID. She talked about how in the world and in policy, there are solvable problems and unsolvable problems. The hard thing was knowing which were which. Was COVID a solvable problem? Or was it, she said, more like terrorism? Something to manage, not to solve. And while she was talking, I just thought, I don't understand. Of course all problems are solvable. Some are hard. Many are bigger than any one individual, even one nation. But surely it goes without saying that problems can be solved. How could it be any other way? And I had a moment of clarity about what my dad had given me. That single belief that nothing was inevitable, that no problems were too big for people to try to solve. That things could always be changed and people could always change them. That belief shaped everything else. We used to joke that if you bumped into my dad in the kitchen, he'd probably want you to work out how to solve global anti-Semitism while the kettle boils. But he did, because why wouldn't he? Problems are there to be solved. He passed away on Shabbat Parashat Vayera, the place in Torah which I think more than any other put this idea into the world, that the world is not just the way things are, but something to challenge and be challenged by. Abraham argues with God to save the people of Sodom. Shall the judge of all the earth not do justice? And God doesn't resist or punish this kind of challenge. Doesn't just accept it, but invites it. Shall I conceal from Abraham that which I'm about to do? It's a story we're so familiar with that I forgot how extraordinary it is until reading again yesterday. God wants us to challenge, to change things. That's the point. That's what my dad taught us. In everything he taught, he wrote, but mainly in the things he chatted to us about while the kettle boiled. The second moment was yesterday morning. I had gotten home from the hospital after he passed away and picked up the last book he published on life-changing ideas from the Parsha. I turned to Vayera and read this. Abraham was chosen so that he would instruct his children and his household after him to keep the way of God by doing what is just and right. He was chosen to be a father. His name means that, Abraham, a father of many nations. He wrote, Abraham was chosen to be a parental role model. And he goes on to ask, how can that be? Abraham abandoned his own father and nearly sacrificed his son. What kind of role model is that? Surely the opposite of what one would expect. And he explains that what Abraham was doing was introducing into the world the idea of the individual. That people were not, as had previously been believed, subjugated to the family unit under the power of the father. People, each uniquely in the image of God, were to be individuals with their own identities, not simply a continuation of a family line. Abraham, as the parental role model, is the parent who makes space for his children to be themselves, he explained. Reading that a few hours after he died, I felt his love overwhelmingly. Because that is what he gave us, above all. He loved us so much and never, ever missed any opportunity in recent years to tell us that. To tell us how proud he was of everything each of us did, but mainly of who we were. How proud he was of each grandchild and every new bit of joy they brought into his world. And because he loved us, each of us in different ways, because we are different people, he gave us the space to become us, not him. So I will remember many things, but those two in particular. He taught us that the world is there to be challenged and that there is no such thing as an unsolvable problem. And he loved us, which meant we could become the people we are, and no child could wish for more.
All right. All right. All right, let's get to some questions here.
That was really nice.
Yes, it was. All right, question number one. Gila remarks that she did not have enough time to formulate the good her father gave her. Why wasn't the 15 to 20 years of adult life sufficient time to formulate this good? Or she started off her presentation, says, I can't even process and imagine all the good that my father has given us. But she's been an adult. She's been with her dad her whole life. She seems to be like a 30, 35-year-old woman. So that comment is not unique to Gila. That's really, I hear that Invariably. Why is that? Now, she, of course, identifies two good elements which she did receive from him, from Rabbi Sacks, her dad. But why she says, I don't have enough time to formulate the good my father has given me. Why is that?
It's like an incalculable thing. You know what I mean? Like, if you had all the time in the world, you wouldn't be able to do it.
All right, so maybe not a perfect job, but let's say my father, my mother, my thing has given me these 5 elements, these 10 elements, these 20 elements. In other words, why are people invariably just shot, you know, they've not really processed that.
Just 1 second, maybe I'm misunderstanding. You say like her actual father or grandfather of Sacks?
That's her father. She's Rabbi Jonathan Sacks' daughter.
Youngest daughter. I think it's the granddaughter. Okay.
Youngest daughter.
I feel that, you know, when you have a person in your life, it's like, it's almost like the roots of a tree. Like, they spread so much and they affect you in so many different ways that you take for granted. But it's unquantifiable and it's really difficult to wrap your head around, like, all the ways that person influenced you and helped you and loved you. You know, it's just unquantifiable.
So that's true. It probably is unquantifiable, but she's not saying that it's an impossible job. She says, I just haven't had a chance to do it.
I think it's when you have something until you lose it, you don't appreciate it because it's normal and you're just, there's no emptiness void, but now that shock that he's gone, like, it can start to process and she can start to appreciate.
I am 100% correct. We do not appreciate what we have until it's gone. We want to believe that the people in our lives that we have are with us forever, even though intellectually we know that's not true. And then because they are providing us all kinds of things, so we never reflect upon that. When do we reflect upon it? When we're forced to reflect upon it, when the person has passed away. So that's point number one. Point number one is that the challenge of a hesped or of a challenge of a parental relationship is we often, it takes... either, let's say, near-death experiences, let's say a person themselves becomes ill and recovers, or their parent becomes sick and recovers, do they start to really appreciate and calculate and formulate the impact, or at least the chief impacts of the person on their lives? You know what I'm saying?
It's something like a lot of, but I'm sure many of us, the idea of having all 4 grandparents or having great-grandparents after post-Holocaust generation, I would always hear from my father, you know, how he appreciated his father, and he didn't wish he got to know his grandfather like I got to know mine.
Right, exactly. So that's the point number one, is that the biggest challenge of a hesped is that a person never has really start to, in a detached way, ask themselves the following question, like, what has been the impact of this person on my life? What is the goodness that they possess? You know what I'm saying? And I think we can all agree that is Gila unique in this of not having formulated the good that you received by your dad in a lifetime? I would say that's the vast majority, if not nearly everybody. You know what I'm saying? That's a very important point, and you know, if all that comes of tonight, to take a moment, you know, to think about, again, I'm just going to say up front, part of, you know, our relationship with our parents are complex. It's got the love, it's got the hate, it's a challenge. All right, we don't have any illusions here. All right, this is a class for mature adults. Relationship with mom and dad are complicated. Some are great, some are good. Some need work. But even the ones that need work, invariably, they have given you, they brought you into this world. That's of course, an intrinsic good. And so many things, so many gifts they have bequeathed upon you. So to think about, just to take in your own mind, make a mental list, like what are the top 5 or 10 things that, you know, your mom and your dad have done for you? Just take, just, you know, whatever, you know, whenever you're taking a walk, just to have that, it's a, you know, spend 5 minutes doing that. That's a worthwhile thought experiment. Point number one. Point number two, what was the goal of Gilas Hesped? Hesped is Hebrew for eulogy. But I'm not going to use the word Hesped. Okay? What was her goal? Or what was her, better, or what were her goals, do you think? What was she trying to accomplish? Everybody felt, I think everybody felt, first of all, before we get to that, raise your hand if you think that she did a very, she did a fine job. Right. She did a very nice job. First of all, you know, this was done very nicely. They had 5 speakers, sort of like taking different quadrants of Rabbi Sacks's life. So they had, you know, the first one who read the eulogy from the current chief rabbi, who's unfortunately in quarantine. Then the second one read remarks of a eulogy from Prince Charles, because he had a personal relation with him. Google that after class, that Prince Charles remarks on Rabbi Sacks. That's, if you're looking for a Kiddush Hashem moment, that thing's money. That's point number two. You can also go to the rabbisacks.org website. You have all 5 eulogies if you want to. I did watch them all. What was her goals? What is she trying to accomplish?
Well, she was trying to communicate her relationship with her father, and then speaking for her siblings as well. It seemed that she was trying to say one very important thing is that she wasn't living in a shadow. He gave his children room to be themselves.
Yes.
And they weren't just the rabbi's child, which I'm sure as a rabbi, you know, there are difficulties children have with their parents.
I am a rabbi's child also. I'm a rabbi who's also a rabbi's child.
Start being in that position.
Right. They have a term for that in the general. They call a PK, a pastor's kid. It's a term. It's like a psychological profile. You know what I mean? You're always in the shadow, and there's tremendous weight. So imagine you're not just the rabbi's child. You're the chief rabbi's child. Not only are you the chief rabbi's child, you're like the child of like the rabbi of the world. Okay, because Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, you know, published a book every year. Would have recorded conversations on BBC with all various intellectuals, from Christopher Hitchens, the atheist, to the Dalai Lama. I mean, he was station across the nation. The guy was like a world figure, in a certain sense.
There was nothing that she communicated.
That was her second point. Go ahead. What else?
Just a little side issue there. Christopher Hitchens, believe it or not, was Jewish. I didn't know that. You wouldn't figure somebody with the name Christopher would be Jewish. Obviously, it was a mixed
marriage. Yeah,
situation.
Yeah. Mom's Jewish.
But,
yeah.
But she kept pointing out about the kettle, that while the kettle was boiling, like taking out those ordinary moments. I remember reading something, or maybe I saw it on TV many years ago, about Golda Meir. How at one point she was meeting at a very critical time in Israel's existence, meeting with like a top senator, like maybe head of the arms committee or something like that.
Yes.
And they were desperate for things. And, you know, she asked him if he wanted to have tea, and she actually went in and made the tea. He didn't understand why she went away, because she was actually making the tea the first time. And then she came back and she would talk about the nitty gritty of arms, which you wouldn't expect from an older Jewish woman. But, you know, so that the intimacy of the relationship can be around the kitchen table or a boiling kettle.
Right.
And I think that's what she communicated, where those what become precious moments, they may seem insignificant. What does it matter if the other, cup of tea is boiling?
Right. So what she used it, but as the normal family thing of people hanging around the kitchen, and there, since we're, this is not just British, but very British, right? While they were putting up a pot of a kettle for some tea.
A spot of tea,
right? So he's expecting everybody to solve global anti-Semitism. So, you know, her first idea was that he communicated an optimistic vision of the world, that there are problems, and we have an obligation to find solutions to the most difficult problems. And, you know, that was great. But let's, stepping back from her two major points, what was she trying to accomplish? Let's take a meta perspective here. She made her two points about her father communicating an optimistic vision of life has challenges and we are obligated to challenge the world and try to solve problems of injustice and, you know, all kinds of issues. And B was the fact that he gave them space as children to be their own people. Those are two messages. But so stepping back from that, what's her meta message? What is she trying to accomplish? What is she trying to accomplish in her eulogy? Those are her two points she's communicating. But what's the broader goal?
I mean,
yeah, Tom.
What I took out from it, and it could be this is simple to you and to everybody else, is just that as a Jewish leader, right, he has his macro obligations and feeling the weight as a in Tikkun Olam and his knowing his place and humility before the people and God, and at the same time as a father to really be each kid, right, when we say Chinuch Lanar Al Pi Darko, that each kid gets, as a father, a person really has to see that they're leading their kids on their way and appreciating their gifts and their talents and humanity and whatever other aspects, so that he was the encompassing full person, especially after all these other eulogies, like you said, right? They gave different aspects. So in the home, she was trying to explain, I see the point of how he was both the father and the leader and really, you know, knew the people, you know, and yeah.
100%. Or obviously she's trying to paint the picture of that he may have been Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks to the world, but he was still dad to me.
Rabbi, I have to depart.
All right, Marvin, good luck on you. Take
See
care.
Everybody on the hiking trails out there.
You got it, man. Be well.
Take it easy. Okay, bye, everybody.
But that's really instrumental to a more broader goal. What is really her goal that she's trying to do? What is she really trying to deliver in addition to that point?
I made up, there's a certain aspect of respect. I don't know if this is what came to me, like a certain aspect of respect for every situation he was in, or the person, or the people, or the, like, as...
So she's trying to... So obviously what she's showing in her 6 minutes of presentation time, to give us an insider look into Rabbi Sacks, a person that we do not know on that level, obviously. I met him a couple times. He was at MJE, you know, but I met the official Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks persona. I did not meet sitting around the kitchen table drinking tea Rabbi Sacks, chilling with his kids. You know what I'm saying? You know what I mean? So, but what the point of what she's trying to accomplish is, the goal of a Hesped, of course, is to talk about what is the excellence of the person, okay? What have we lost is really the implied question of a Hesped. And you paint that picture through certain stories and certain, you know, and link it to principles. So she's sharing the principle of just like Avram, she made the analogy, just as Avram challenged God to understand what's going on with the destruction of stone, that we are supposed to challenge our circumstance to find a just situation, to resolve things better, to improve the world. So she's showing honor to her father by painting a intimate picture of him and his personal excellence, with stories and a reflection, which that we would not know. Okay, so that's really what the goal of a eulogy is in essence to identify what are the key qualities of excellence of the person.
Rabbi, can I add something?
Go ahead.
I actually read from Rabbi Sacks himself, may his memory be a blessing, that he officiated many eulogies and burials himself.
Sure, he was an active rabbi. Before he was the chief rabbi, he was once upon a time a regular shul rabbi. He moved up the rabbinic food chain. Okay.
And he writes that, something that he began to notice, a common denominator, is that in people's eulogies, they would never really speak about, oh, my dad, he had so much money and he worked so hard and he had the biggest cases. That they're always about, like, he was there when you needed him. He always had like a nice thing to say when you were down. And the point that Rabbi Sacks made was that sometimes we confuse the urgent for the important. And we focus on the urgent things, like making money, like the big business meeting. But what's important is really what people mention in eulogies, being there for one another, loving each other, that sort of thing.
Adrian, excellent point, and that takes us to our first source of the class, which was called a perfect setup there. Thank you, Adrian.
You guys prepare that?
No, that was not prepared. That was just purely. Okay, here we go. So the Rambam talks about an interesting comment in the laws of mezuzah. So let me have somebody read. Adrian, Bavakasha, so you made the point. Let's read out the idea. The Rambam talks about mezuzah in the fifth chapter of the Laws of Mezuzah. Go ahead.
A person must show great care in the observance of the mitzvah of mezuzah. Through its observance, whenever a person enters or leaves the house, he will encounter the unity of the name of the Holy One, blessed be He, and remember His love for him. Thus, he will awake from his sleep and his obsession with the vanities of time, and recognize that there is nothing which lasts for eternity except the knowledge of the Creator of the world. This will motivate him to regain full awareness and follow the paths of the upright.
Very excellent. Thank you. So the Rambam is saying here that basically the goal of the mezuzah, or one of the goals of the mezuzah, is essentially, you look at the mezuzah, you don't have to kiss it, but you should pay attention to the mezuzah, A, recognize that it has the two parshiot of Shema, and in those two parshiot you have all the core principles of Judaism. Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokim Hashem Echad, God's oneness. V'ahavta et Hashem Elokecha b'chol levavcha, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart. V'shinat levanecha, you should teach your children, etc., etc., right? So he's basically saying it's an opportunity to look at the mission of a Jew, look at the vision of the Jew, wake up from the, and he says, he has a phrase here, which you mentioned before, Adrian, which was very prescient, his obsession with the vanities of the,
Sacks mentioned it.
Right, so whatever. So Rabbi Sacks' point is that whenever he noticed that when people give eulogies, what do they not mention? They do not talk about the obsessions of the vanities of time, about how many homes did the person have? How many cars did he have? How much money did he have? How much honor was given him? All the things that people spend all their time for. Funny thing is, when it comes to the eulogy, it's never mentioned. Why is that? Because it doesn't have much value. It's not going to last. When it is our time to go, we are, the tradition in is to wear, a person's buried in the kittel, that white robe, right? What does the kittel not have as part of the garment? It's missed, as a garment, it's missing something very important.
The kittel doesn't have pockets.
The kid has no pockets. You know why? Because you don't need a pocket. Because you ain't taking. Because as the famous Broadway play and the movie, you can't take it with you.
Can a Kittle have a pocket? That's
you could, but I'm just saying there's Kittles that, you know, you can wear people. We wear Kittles. Many Ashkenazim wear Kittles at the Seder. People wear Seder at Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, whatever. Different customs, whatever. Under the chuppah, whatever. That's. But the Kittle in its classic use, which is for, you know, your last wearing, okay? That's the key point.
The pharaohs, they try to, you know, cheat the system by being buried with all their goods.
Right, because they believed that they were going to have a material existence afterwards and they need to bring stuff. Money, they need to bring food, because they thought they're going to travel to a different place. Now, the truth is, we do agree. Well, we're going to get to that. Now, so here's the point. How does the mezuzah lesson about the eternity of knowledge guide our crafting of a eulogy?
You try to talk about, you talk about like what really matters in life.
Exactly. What, in other words, what are the things that are critical, which are eternal, and how that person embodied them? Let's say it was kindness for a moment.
Kindness, family.
Right. In other words, they talked about the, you know, so you're going to talk about stories about how they embodied that principle. You know what I'm saying? But the principle is kindness, which is really, we say on Yom Kippur many, many times, Hashem Hashem, Kel Rachum Vechanun. God is compassionate, you know, he's compassionate. So basically, when a person is compassionate, whether they're aware of it or not, they're really following in God's footsteps.
So, to make a distinction, you know, I do think that being kind and chesed is very important. But I think you alluded to this. I just want to, like, clarify it a little bit. It's the knowledge, wisdom, that, like, lives on forever. Like, when a person passes Rabbi Sacks' books, they're going to be read for, you know, hopefully hundreds of years.
Yeah, yes.
Knowledge is persistent.
But we're not talking, but, so here, this, okay, so let me pivot. One second, do I have to bring that up? Hold on. I'm going to get to that for a moment. Hold on to that question. I just want to pivot to our Parsha for a moment. All right, Suzanne, read us. We got to read a little piece of the Parsha. These are the first two psukim of the Parsha.
Sarah had lived to be 127 years old. These were the years of Sarah's life. Sarah died in Kiryat Arba, also known as Hebron, in the land of Canaan. Abraham came to eulogize Sarah and to weep for her.
Okay. What occurs first, crying or eulogizing? This is a simple question.
Crying.
Crying. When a person loses somebody, it's simply uncontrollable. It's an automatic reaction of the profundity of the loss, the shock of the loss. Okay? So and now, let's go into each one. What's the purpose of crying? And
is that so simple, or could a person say, it depends on the emotional aspect, and then it could be after eulogizing and reflecting, they realize the loss and they cry.
Okay, so let's get to the components. What is the purpose of crying at the funeral, during Shiva? What is the purpose of crying? How does that fit into the whole gestalt of, you know, death and burial and mourning in Judaism?
Are you asking a scientific question? There's a scientific reason behind it.
I mean, Rabbi.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Scientific, psychological. Go ahead.
We have in Torah any emotional time, right? The two brothers meet up, they cry. The Yaakov and Yosef meet up, they cry. Right? There's a lot of crying whenever there's emotion, just to show an emotion.
Right. So crying is always either you can have crying for happiness, right, as you're talking about, like a reunion. So that's when you're emotionally overwhelmed, you will automatically cry. And if you're overwhelmed that with negative emotions, you will cry out of sadness. Both extremes. Okay? Like, when a woman gets, you know, when a woman or a man, you know, typically a woman, sometimes even a man, actually both, gets called up for an Oscar, right? And they come up, you know, they come running down to take their Oscar. You know, they're oftentimes dabbing their eyes. Why? Because they're so overwhelmed. They've been working as an actor or an actress literally 10, 20, 30 years. And this is the pinnacle of their whole thing. And they're just overwhelmed with joy. They can't, they just can't, you know, they pull themselves together to be able to read their little speech, right? So that's the crying. So crying, of course, so it's a catharsis. It's a venting of the sadness, of the tremendous sense of loss, the grief. It's the psychological component and manifesting the magnitude of the loss. How devastating is it? I am crying inconsolably.
So that's
crying. It's the cathartic emotive response to the death, and which de facto shows the depth of the loss. If a person's relative dies and they don't shed a tear, either there's two possibilities. Either the relationship is so dysfunctional, that's one problem, or B, they're so psychologically either they're in denial, whatever. There's a, that's not a healthy response. Healthy response, crying. Crying good. Crying good.
There's a benefit to crying.
Yes, it's all in order. There's also a therapeutic value, part of the grieving process.
Other than the personal, it also works to bring people together.
Yes, by the way, there were professionals in the time of the Talmud. You're going to be shocked. There were people called the Mekonin and the Mekononos, who were the professional lamenters, who would cry. They were actors. So to dramatize, to get everybody feeling the loss, they'd have people, literally you would hire, in addition to the eulogizers, there'd be another character, people who would cry. So people would be able to feel the magnitude of the loss. It was a paid position. Okay? Now, you might say, well, no, because sometimes people emotionally be able to, now, and I've seen this many times. Here's the situation. Person dies. Everybody goes into the funeral hall, right? And there are speeches, and people are quiet and respectful and somber, no tears. Then you'll get, like, the daughter or the mother. All she has to do to get everybody crying is to start to cry. Boom! Everybody's crying. Okay? Because she is just bewailing the profound loss, just communicating in a nonverbal manner of the man to the loss, and that just hits. Everybody has various walls of defense, and that just cuts through it all.
So that's what I'm saying. There's an evolutionary purpose to crying, which is when a person has a loss and they're weak, crying. It shows vulnerability and it brings people together.
It could. That's a good possibility. In order to saying what is the evolutionary benefit of crying? Okay, that's a good point. I don't know, but what it is doing now is everything that I think we just said. Now, what is eulogizing?
Love can be bad, but if you cry with people, it can actually be healthy.
It is, but crying. Crying over the loss of a dead person, first of all, it's natural and it's a mitzvah. In other words, to hold yourself back, to bottle yourself up, and to not emote is not good. And you have to allow yourself to let yourself go appropriately during this time. Okay, that's point one. Point two, eulogizing. We've already discussed it. What's the goal of eulogizing?
Well, I felt like part of what made a husband, like for my father, so difficult was to honor him. And how can you sum up in such a short amount of time all that this person did for me? And you want people to know this was you know, this was, you know, at least to me, a wonderful person and contributed so much, at least to me and all the good qualities. How do you do that? And so, and to honor him in such a short time. And
it's very difficult. It's very difficult. Also, it's a very difficult task to do, especially when you're at your, you're not at your best. It's two things. It's a hard job in general, A, and B, you're at your most fragile point. So it's a very hard job, by the way. I want to share that. That's why, in a certain sense, having a rabbi as well to speak as well is helpful. So what I would do, let's say I don't know the deceased, okay? So what do I have to do is I have to get all the stories. I have to get all the stories from the family, sort of do a download, and sort of try to reconstruct a personality. But really the goal is, as you said very nicely, the goal is to honor the deceased, A, and find those eternal qualities that are embodied in that person and share that with the community. How can they live on through everybody else? By being educated by their values and virtues. You know what I'm saying? That's the goal. That's what you think. Now, based upon that, why did Avram, when he showed up to Hebron, and there is Sarah lying in state, the whole town's there, he gets up in front of everybody, and he begins to tell them, share a eulogy. Why did he not just have that? Why did, it says specifically, he didn't just sit there and just cry. Even though this is the woman that he spent over 100 years with. This is the love of his life. They were not, you know what I mean? What is being communicated powerfully by the fact that he sort of like sucked it up, if you will, emotionally sucked it up, which if you're giving a eulogy, you have to do that because you can't give a eulogy if you're crying every 2 seconds. So you gotta, it's hard. You gotta suck it up. You know what I mean? And then you gotta step up to the lectern. Best you can. You got to have tissues in your hand. I also recommend water. And you got to deliver it. So why did he do the eulogy first, then the crying?
The first thing that comes to mind is the binding of Isaac. When God asked him, you know, to sacrifice his son. Because, you know, I think the point and the reason he was so ready and willing to do it, to actually kill his son, not just eulogize him, but like actually commit the deed of killing him, is because there's a hierarchy of values, you know?
Okay.
And like in the hierarchy of values, family is usually right up top. Like your parents, especially your children, they're like in the right at the top of the hierarchy.
Yes.
But Abraham understood that there's something on top of that, which was God, and he was the first person to really, you know, be spreading that message around, which is there's something bigger than just our material existence.
True. So how does that apply based upon that principle? Why the elect to first present, and this, and we see from the next verses, there was the Chiti tribe, Bnei Chet, the Chet tribe, in Kiryat Arba, in Hebron, which of course in Jaila MGA, we visit there every year, we go there. Why is he doing eulogy first, if that's the case?
There's justice in the world. There's a rhyme and reason, and it's not just a mechanical, chaotic world with battling gods. Rather, there's like a true justice.
But he's not giving them a shear. He's not giving him the Parsha Shir. He's not giving him. He's not talking about any ideas about God. He's talking about Sarah. He's eulogizing Sarah. Why is he doing that first?
Brooke? Is it more important that her, like her personal qualities of goodness and hospitality and everything should live on, and that's more important than his own personal feelings about the loss?
100% correct. Sarah is not just his wife. She is his wife. But she is essentially the mother of civilization. So before you can cry, you need to understand What exactly are we crying about? What have we lost here? So what he did was, and sorrow was uniquely private. It's, as we say in the last week's Parsha, the angel says to Abraham, where is Sarah? What does he say? She's in the tent. She was not a spotlight person, but she was a powerful person. She was an impact player. The Rashis we've done in years past, Avram would teach and convert the men, and Sarah would teach and convert the women. She was literally responsible for 50% of the entire community. Okay? And it's not just, you know, 1 + 1 = 2. It's 1 + 1 = 3. In other words, she was much more. The loss is not simply that Avram's going to go on just without his sidekick, Sarah. No. In fact, Rabbi Soloveitchik already noted that the essential stories of Avraham are already reported. There's no other stories except for a little small story with marrying another woman very little before his own death, which he inferred that Avraham's greatness was in fact dependent upon Sarah. It was not Avraham the great man. It was Avraham the great man. But Avram the great man, who was in partnership with Sarah the great woman. So he, therefore, it's important for people to understand, what have we lost? Who was this enigmatic figure, Sarah? What were her values and virtues? And now we get to the point is, and in a certain sense, is she gone? The answer is no. Judaism maintains that you have a soul. That soul is what has the, is where the qualities of perfection, your ideas of God, and the your virtue and your values live on. And I'm going to, without getting into a complex metaphysical conversation, that soul is with Hashem. I'm going to say in a, just a simple way. That soul exists eternally and is with Hashem. So in a certain sense, and not to mention, as was mentioned before, that their values are lived on within the people, in the sense that they are going to be acting like Sarah. And that's the nechama. That's what another goal of a hesped is, comfort. What's the comfort? The comfort is knowing that, A, that the person is not really in his... person not died. Now, they're not around to continue to help us and educate us and guide us and take care of us, but they still exist in a real way. It's only because we are very self-oriented that we think that's a loss. They still exist and they're fully existing. That's point number one. Point number two is that their values, their virtues, their teachings, their example lives on. And that's the, one of the goals of the Hesped, is to try to abstract, to deconstruct a complex life, and to share some life lessons that people can absorb. And as Adrian said before, and Rabbi Sachs said, and it's not about you should work harder and make a lot more money. You should buy extra cars and extra houses and extra vacations and everything. Because when your child will talk about you, when your relative will talk about you after 120, it will not be about those things. It will be about, people sense in that moment what is real. Unfortunately, people are not educated in what a hesped is. And they oftentimes bring up like memories. Yeah, and dad would take us for ice cream. And I really enjoyed vacationing in Cancun. Now, I'm not saying those are not valuable to share among the family, but that's not the, those are not their eternal virtues. Sunbathing in Cancun. That's desirable. In fact, I would not mind being sunbathing in Cancun. But that's not the eternal quality of the person. So to come full circle, I, like, and so many people across the Jewish community feel sad for the loss of not one but two Torah giants, Rabbi David Feinstein and Rabbi Lord Jonathan Sacks. But the Nechama is, number one, they're not dead in a real sense. They are living with Hashem. That's point number one. And two, they have left a legacy where we can learn from them, and to the extent that we can emulate them and be inspired by them and be educated by them. In that sense, they live on. And it's our responsibility to take advantage of that, to really invest in that. And I will share just a cautionary tale that we all, as we discussed earlier, the nature of ourself, of the human condition, is to not appreciate what we have until it's gone. So if you have family and you have friends, that's not eternal. Reflect about what you love and like about them, their eternal values and virtues. Celebrate that, learn from that. And if that, by the way, means that if they're if there is unresolved business, don't let it be unresolved. Because, I as a rabbi dealing with families are messy businesses, to put it very simply. And people, all of us always believe, I thought I had more time. So that's something that we can take away from that. In other words, we don't know when a person is going to pass, but take advantage of the people who you love in your life and cherish them and learn from them, and also thank them. Thank them when they're living. Articulate your gratitude now. Don't let it be from a lectern to an audience only. So I think, just to put it in full thing, the goal of a eulogy is to identify the qualities, eternal qualities and virtues and values of a relative or a friend. And you bring that to bear by sharing stories that exemplify that. And you do it in a way that's emotionally impactful. It says that the Talmud has a great phrase that the reward for a good eulogy are tears. You want to get them crying. You want to get them thinking. You want to get them feeling. It's not a dry intellectual presentation. It's an emotionally engaging journey. Typically, a eulogy is 5 to 8 minutes. You want to share maybe 3-4 ideas painted with a brush of personal stories that only you had access to because you personally live with them and experience them. That's a good eulogy. That's why it says there's a debate in the Talmud. Is it primarily for honoring the deceased, or is it for honoring the people by sharing these values and virtues to them? Okay? The answer is both. So I know this is not the most upbeat topic. It is the Parsha. It has what happened to us. But the good news is the Nechama is, the comfort is, that when a person passes away, they're not really gone. They're not in our life on a day-to-day basis, but their existence continues, and certainly their impact continues if you allow it to. And that's something which is a comfort as well. Okay, and any questions?
I'm reading this book. You can't really see it because of my background, so let me remove that.
To Heal a Fractured World. That's one of his classics.
And when I read it, Like, I actually hear his voice.
Right. I want to, if we're recommending things, Rabbi Sacks' speech, I think Rabbi Wiles posted it. He spoke at MJE, I don't know, maybe 10 years already. It was like home run city. It's on Wayutara. I think Rabbi Wilds posted it. If you're going for a walk, you're doing some chores, or you have some time just to relax, I will just listen to that. You will be inspired. You will be uplifted. Okay? And you'll think about Rabbi Sacks in the right way. That's what I recommend. He just did. I cannot tell you. I'll give you a story about this year. A story about the story. I was with a person who was I brought to the Shear, who was a supporter of MJE, a president of a Reform temple. Okay? You know, that person's not Orthodox. Okay? To listen to Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, who's not just a Orthodox rabbi, but the Orthodox rabbi, the chief rabbi, right? And this is a Harvard-educated person, also went to Cambridge, very bright person. He said to me, and he was like 60, 50, 60 at the time in that zone. He says, if I would have had Rabbi Sacks as my rabbi when I was younger, I would have been a different person. He told me that since he heard that shear, afterwards he asked me for the recording because he loved it. He heard that lecture, he told me, 7 times. So, you know, that's part of the great gift of Rabbi Sacks. You know, that's renowned. But I'm just saying, the power of a shear, the power of a powerful idea is sometimes boundless. So, and if you can't give that shear, share the shear. That's it.
Actually, one quick idea is that, you know, the reason Abraham eulogizes before crying, there's different types of crying.
True.
Crying out of, like, loss, like actual loss. And then there's crying of, like, desperation and just, like, chaos and, like, there's different types of crying.
Correct.
And when you, I think you taught this once, that when someone passes, we say, Baruch Dayan Emet.
Yes. Yes, you have to, if you're part of the seven relatives, you have to say the blessing that, blessed you, God, King of the Universe, who is the true judge. Because that's dealing with the part of us that wants to, that feels like, this is not fair. I've been shafted. We needed more time. So that's the point. But that's the whole thing. So if you think about it, I'll just end on this last little point before I say goodnight to you all, is that Avram's act of kindness to the people was, he did not go into his tent to indulge himself in crying about the loss of his wife. He felt it was more important to serve the community and share with each and every one of them the greatness of one of the greatest women that ever walked this earth with them. And when he had done that, he cried. He went into his tent and he cried. And then, unfortunately, he had the travail of having to arrange a burial spot. But we've discussed that in classes past. You can go to Wayutara. We discussed the whole negotiation for the burial spot at a different class. All right, everyone, have a great night. Lalo Tov, some I might see you guys tomorrow.
Rabbi Pinney?
Yes, Suzanne.
Can I ask a quick, do you have a place I'm supposed to ask you a reputable where to get a mezuzah, the scroll?
Yes. I'll email to you.
Okay, thank you.
You got it.
Yeah, where do you live? I have some extra mezuzahs.
Oh, you do? I'm in the Upper East Side.
Maybe we'll find a way to get it to you. I have, from who's on my MGE trip here? Shane, are you on it?
Thank you, Rabbi Lila Tov.
Okay. 2016 with the thing with Yudi and Misharm.
Lila Tov, thank you.
Bye, bro. Have a good night.
I bought a bunch of mezuzahs from this guy named Sherm on the NJE trip.
So connect with Suzanne. Connect with Suzanne.
Thank you.
All the best.
Thank you.
Bye.
Rabbi, thank you. And also thank you for speaking with Mrs. Zimmer. Give me a good
My pleasure, man.
Win-win.
Oh, so you got the gig?
They got the gig.
As you should.